My name is Herb Montgomery, and I'm the director of Renewed Heart Ministries. We are a not-for-profit group that is passionate about rediscovering, following, and helping others rediscover the teachings and sayings of the historical Jesus of Nazareth. We believe that these teachings have an intrinsic value in informing the work of nonviolently confronting, liberating, and transforming our world into a safe, more just, more compassionate home for us all. If you would like to support the work of Renewed Heart Ministries, I'll tell you how you can do so at the end of this podcast. For now, we simply want to thank you for listening. I'm going to endeavor to actually record the presentations this weekend. Because of our setting, I don't know if the recordings will turn out, but we're going to try. If any of you would over the course of the weekend, say, man, I'd like to go back and re-listen to that or revisit that, I'm going to endeavor to do that. We'll put it up on our website for free afterwards. If it doesn't work out, as Pat shared, this is a much larger 17 presentation series that we're actually just pulling out some of the highlights for four presentations here. And so that's to give you a little bit of idea of what we're doing. I want to also thank you for inviting me to spend this weekend with you. AWC has, I don't know how you guys do it, but you guys have kind of wiggled your way into the hearts, our hearts at Renewed Heart Ministries. And we love you guys. And we feel very fortunate to be here with you this weekend. For those of you who are not very familiar with Renewed Heart Ministries, we are a ministry that is very passionate about helping people rediscover the teachings of the historical Jesus. There's a growing concern today that Christianity is moving in a direction that doesn't resemble much of what Jesus historically was about. And our passion is to try to help people get back to those teachings. We feel the teachings of Jesus are still relevant today, that they have a purpose in informing our work of nonviolently confronting, awakening, liberating our world, helping make the world a safer, more just, more compassionate home for us all. We're going to ease into the book of Revelation tonight. Tomorrow is going to be much more intense, and I'll put that out there in the beginning. We're going to have two presentations in the morning, and then we're going to have one presentation tomorrow night. So whatever damage we do tomorrow morning, you will have all afternoon to recover. Really, the one presentation that I care about most out of all of them is tomorrow night's. Everything else is preparatory for tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is when I'm hoping the coin drops in the slot. Some more preliminary comments about the book of Revelation. Revelation has a long track record with Seventh-day Adventists. And the last time I checked, AWC is a Seventh-day Adventist church. Is that correct? It is not my burden this weekend to harmonize everything that I'm going to share with you with the interpretation of the book of Revelation by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. What I'm going to be sharing with you is how the first audience would have heard and interpreted these images in their own setting. Revelation has been heard by many generations. Adventists have their spin on what it means for us today. I think that even that interpretation of the book can benefit from going back and understanding how the original audience would have heard it. Let's talk about that hearing of the book. Take your handouts with me, Revelation 1, 1 through 3. Once again, we're going to ease into it tonight. I'm not going to hold you long this evening. Revelation 1, 1 through 3, the revelation from Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants what must soon take place. They would have heard that not as something happening in 2016. They would have heard that as relevant to them. This is something that's applicable to them. He made known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw. That is the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who, notice how this works. Blessed is the one who, what does it say? Reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written, because the time is near. So let's talk about blessed are those who read it and blessed are those who hear it. We live in a very different relationship to the Bible than the early church lived in. First of all, not everybody had a Bible in the early church. If you can imagine following Jesus without a Bible. This is before Gutenberg's press. The Bible was always understood not individually, but collectively. If someone had a letter like this one from Patmos, it would have been read in a context much like this. And this is important for us because we go astray when we take the book of Revelation and we sit down by ourselves and we lean into it so deeply that we get focused on the trees that we miss the forest. The way they would have encountered this book auditorily would have been the great themes of the book of Revelation. How many have seen people get into the minutiae of the book of Revelation to the degree that it becomes unhealthy? How many have seen that? That's not what we're going to be doing this weekend. What John would have been doing, or whomever the author of the book of Revelation was, regardless of where you are on that spectrum, what this book would have been doing was casting before them themes that they were already familiar with that have subtle twists that they would have gotten not through long hours of individualistic poring over text, but of a communal listening to this letter being read to them as a group. That should come as an encouragement to anybody who's not a book learner. This book was not supposed to be approached the way that we approach it today. It was also written, and this passage isn't in this handout tonight, but it was written to the church. It was not an evangelistic tool. It was written to those who were already believers, already endeavoring to follow the teachings of Jesus, to encourage them in the midst of martyrdom and persecution to keep following, that their vision for the world was going to work. Now, that produces challenges for us today, because here we are 2,000 years later, and we're still waiting. So we'll talk about a little bit of that tomorrow. But blessed are those who hear it, who read it, and those who hear it. So one reader, many hearers, and they take to heart what is written, because the time is, once again, if you were a first century 2,000 years ago hearing this letter, you would not have thought, this doesn't have anything to do with me. This is for all those people 2,000 years from now. You would have thought, this is very relevant to the struggles that I am going through in endeavoring to follow Jesus today. Something we need to understand about that audience. Most of them were still very Jewish. The book of Revelation is not a Gentile book. It is a very Jewish book. And although it's Christian, it builds on Jewish apocalyptic imagery. And we'll talk about a little bit of that tomorrow, but there are Jewish apocalyptic writings that are referenced in the book of Revelation, especially Revelation 13, Revelation 14, that aren't in our Christian scriptures. They would have been first century Jewish documents. We have those, and I go into some detail with those in the 17 presentation series. We're not going to get into that this weekend for the sake of time. But many of these images that are in the book of Revelation that are so foreign to us, a friend of mine likes to envision it this way. Imagine 2,000 years from now, someone finds a newspaper from our time today, and they see a comic strip with an elephant and a donkey on it. Well, we would understand immediately what that's talking about in our day. Very familiar to us. That imagery would mean nothing to them 2,000 years from now. So one of the reasons the book of Revelation is so difficult is because we are millennia removed from these images and these documents and this type of writing. We're going to try to break it down. I'm going to bring out some of that this weekend. Let's talk about the ancient Jewish hope for a moment again. Jewish people, the hope of the Jewish people was not to one day die and go to heaven. Their hope was not to one day become some disembodied soul like the Greeks on some far distant cloud. They weren't trying to attain celestial bliss. The celestial shore was not their goal. Their hope was that one day Messiah would come and that all injustice, all oppression, and all violence in the earth would be put right here. Their hope was not to believe this, 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 and this, so that when I die, or at some other point in the future, post-mortem, I might go to some other place. Their hope, their vision, was that one day God would come back to his people, liberate his people, and not just his own people, but the entire world, where all violence, oppression, and injustice would be put right. That's going to become important to understand as you read the book of Revelation. The goal of the book of Revelation is not to arrive somewhere else. Even if you go all the way to the end of the book, Revelation ends not with a God who takes his people to his home forever, but of a God who eventually ends up where? How many finished the book of Revelation? Yeah, he ends here with a new heaven and a new earth. God comes here to spend eternity with us. Very Jewish theme. Very foreign to a lot of Christian thinking today. A lot of evangelical Christian thinking is, there are large sectors of Christianity that are very little concerned with what's going on in the here and now. Their goal is just to get to post-mortem, that non-smoking section. So two related themes that we'll be looking at in the book of Revelation. There's lots of themes. I've only picked two for this weekend because we only have four presentations. But one is Jesus' nonviolent revolution. Most, and I mean most, there are only a few who divert from this, but most scholars of the historical Jesus believe that Jesus taught nonviolence. You can't get away from it. Gandhi used to say the only people that think Jesus didn't teach nonviolence are the Christians. Everybody knows Jesus taught nonviolence. This is a challenge for most historical Jesus scholars when it comes to the book of Revelation. Because in the book of Revelation, I'm going to pick out four of them, and we'll talk about all four tomorrow. These are the four chapters we're going to be dealing with tomorrow. You have Revelation 6, where you have the wrath of him who's on the throne and the wrath of the Lamb, and what are the kings and those in positions of privilege in the status quo? Well, what are they calling out for? Do you remember? For the rocks to hide us in the caves. May the rocks fall on us. Hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Even that language, though, is problematic if you lean into it. I mean, the wrath of a lamb? Think of that for a moment. How many have ever run from an angry baby sheep? It's not very terrifying. So the language, see, and this is whoever the author was of this book, he's very subtle with his, he does that over and over again. We'll see it. But you have Revelation 14 as well. Revelation 14, you've got this one that treads the winepress of the wrath of God alone, and the blood comes up to the bridle of the horses. That doesn't sound very nonviolent, does it? You have Revelation 19. Where there's a white horse and its rider with a garment drenched in blood and a sword with which he will strike down the nations and call for the eagles to come and feast on the flesh of those who are annihilated. That doesn't sound very nonviolent. And when you get to the end, you have those who are not written in the book of life, picked up by the scruff of their necks and pitched into a lake of fire where it states they will be tormented forever and ever and ever. That doesn't sound very... The imagery... Now, I know Adventists are annihilationists and we interpret this in a different way, but the imagery of the book of Revelation is not annihilation, but eternal torment. So we'll talk about that some more tomorrow as well. But anyway, the whole point of bringing all those four chapters out is that historical Jesus scholars who were convinced that Jesus taught nonviolence, they split about right down the middle when it comes to the book of Revelation. Half of those scholars believe that the book of Revelation is so violent that it cannot be harmonized with the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so they never deal with the book of Revelation. They just throw it out. They say it's not even worth our time to try to understand. But the basis of that is on the disharmony they feel between the violence of this book, the division of this book. Revelation, in their interpretation, is all about a God who is drawing lines in the sand, and these people are over here, and these people are over here. And we have learned through history that that way of doing life, that way of human beings envisioning a God, and that way of relating to one another is not life-giving. It's destructive. When it's us versus them, that's not life-giving. So these scholars who believe that Jesus was more inclusive, that Jesus didn't draw lines in the sand, that Jesus was bringing people together rather than dividing them, they're in, they're out. No, let's bring them all together. Those scholars, half of those scholars say the book of Revelation can't be harmonized. There's another half of peace scholars which believe the book of Revelation can be harmonized with the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it's their resources that we're going to be looking at this weekend. I'm going to endeavor to give you the best of the best of the best of the peace scholars' work on the book of Revelation. And hopefully it will make sense to you. The second theme that we'll be looking at tomorrow is the Jewish theme of the conversion of the nations. And this is significant. The Jewish hope was not, once again, of arriving at some post-mortem heaven. It was of a time, once again, where all justice and violence and oppression would be put right. And that not that the nations would be annihilated, but that the nations would then be converted to follow this Messiah too. It was a very inclusive understanding of eschatology, of end time things. So we're going to look at that theme as well. So the two themes we're going to be looking at in the book of Revelation, nonviolence and the conversion of the nations. Tomorrow is going to be primarily conversion of the nations. Tonight, we're going to just begin unpacking some of that nonviolence. Let's jump right to Revelation 4 and just get into it. Enough preliminary talks. Revelation 4, 1 through 5. After this, I looked, and there was before me a door standing open in heaven, and the voice that I heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. This throne room is where the entire book of Revelation takes place. Even when we get to chapter 20, 21, and 22, we're still in this throne room. He's still in this context. All the characters that are about to be introduced in this chapter are still involved in the end of the book. So all of the whole book takes place right here. This is the centerpiece. Revelation 5, 1 through 5 says, "I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll." And I wish we had time this weekend to go into what that's all about. We don't. It's in the 17-part series. "With writing on both sides, sealed with seven seals, I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?' But no one in heaven or on the earth could open the scroll or even look inside of it. I wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See the,'" what does it say?
Lion.
"The lion from the tribe of
Judah.
The root of David has triumphed, and he is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." This imagery is some of the most violent imagery in the Old Testament. And the author of the book of Revelation is pointing it out for a very subversive reason, which we'll see in a moment. But in order to get there, let's look at it. If you can see it, I know the font is small in the gray section. Look over at Genesis 49, 9 through 12. I'm going to stand back here and hopefully be able to see it in the light. Do we have lights?
Yeah, we're
good. Oh, man, you guys are on top of it.
Not really, but thanks for
perfect.
Can you see now?
I can. Thank you. Thank you. So this first imagery of the lion of the tribe of Judah, very tribal, very us versus them, but it's even more than that. Genesis 49, 9 through 12. "You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the, what's that word? Prey. What if you have prey, what else do you have? A predator, that's right. So it's a very predator-prey kind of language. My son, like a lion, he crouches and lies down like a lioness who dares to rouse them. Ladies, there's that. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff. Remember that imagery, because the author of the book of Revelation will bring that up as well. From between his feet until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations, there's that conversion of the nations, shall be his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in, what does it say? And his robes in the blood of grapes, and his eyes will be darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. This lion, predator, prey, God's people are the lion. In Isaiah, it talks about lions laying down with lambs. So just keep that in mind. Isaiah 11. By the time we get to Isaiah, we begin to see some changes, but not many. Isaiah 11, 1 through 16. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. Now, what is this? This is the root of David. This is that section. We've talked about the lion from the tribe of Judah, found in Genesis. The passage we're looking at in Revelation 5 also talks about the root of David. It says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what his eye sees or decide by what his judge or what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. Every time you in the Old Testament see the word righteousness, think of the word justice. If not justice is in the sense of retribution, it's justice in the sense of restoring that which is right, that which is righteous. It says, a righteousness, he will judge the needy. He will, with justice, he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. These are the underdogs, the marginalized, the oppressed, the disinherited. It says, he will strike the earth. Now watch this. Even though it's with justice for the oppressed, it says, he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips, he will, what does it say? Slay the wicked. I had a friend once say to me in high school, he said, so you're looking forward to the second coming, correct? I said, yes. And he said, and you believe that on that, when Jesus comes back, he's going to slay all of the wicked. I said, yes. He says, so you're looking forward to the day when Jesus comes back and I die and I'm destroyed. Yeah. Didn't have the desired effect on him that I wanted it to. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. Our goals are important, but the means whereby which we attain those goals are just as vital. Now watch what it says. Here will be the result. After you slay the wicked, watch what will be the result. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, the little child will lead them. Why will this non-violence take place? Why will all violence in the earth be brought to an end? Because the wicked have all been what? Slain. What I want you to notice, whether you agree with this or not, is that this is non-violence through violent means. How many can at least say that? The reason we have peace is because we've killed everybody that didn't want to cooperate. We've been trying that as a human race for thousands of years. This was the Jewish vision as well. The cow will feed together with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like an ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den. The young child will be put into its hand into the viper's nest. Once again, all of these, no more destruction, no more lethal, no more dangerous. All that stuff will be done away with. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse, that's the root of David, will stand as a banner for the people. The nations will rally to him. Here's the conversion of the nations. And his resting place will be glorious. In that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the surviving remnant of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the Mediterranean. He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. I cannot wait till tomorrow where we see what the author does with these. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish. Judah's enemies will be destroyed. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah hostile toward Ephraim. They will swoop down the slopes of Philistia to the west. Together they will plunder the people to the east. Notice the plundering. Watch that. They swoop down on Philistia. Who are the Philistines? To the Jewish, to the Hebrew people. Who were the Philistines? Do you remember? Talk to me. Who were they? Yeah, these were their enemies. So we're going to swoop down on our enemies. We're going to plunder the people of the east, our enemies of the east. The Lord will dry up the gulf of the Egyptian sea in scorching wind. He will sweep his band over the Euphrates River. He will break it up into seven streams so that anyone can cross over in sandals. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people and what is left from Assyria for as there was for Israel when they came up from Egypt. So again, this is going to be a great exodus of the exiles. They're going to be brought back. There's going to be peace finally. No more violence, no more oppression. But it's going to come through, notice some of the imagery, slaying the wicked, swooping down on our enemies, and plundering those that are opposed to us. Again, it's a nonviolent end through a violent means. Whether we agree with that or not, this is the paradigm the early Jewish listeners of this book would have, these are the images that would have been brought to their mind whenever they heard this. I looked, and in front of the Lamb, he heard about a lion of the tribe of Judah, of the root of Jesse. This is the type of imagery that they would have associated with that type of language. Revelation 22, it talks about the root of David again. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the offspring of David, the bright and morning. This is challenging because in Isaiah, the root of Jesse, yes, restores justice, does away with oppression, brings all violence to an end, but again, it's through slaying the enemies, plundering our enemies, swooping down on our enemies. This is not the way the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John taught us to overcome injustice, violence, and oppression. Jesus did not teach the way of slaying our enemies. Jesus taught the controversial, risky and dangerous way of learning how to love our enemies. There have been those that have sought to apply this in their own spheres of influence throughout history. It is a means whereby we don't seek to destroy our enemies. We seek to win them. We seek to convert them. But again, it's problematic because Jesus is saying, I'm this one back in Isaiah. He's claiming these titles. How many can feel or at least sense the beginnings of the conflict that scholars have with these images? How many can see it? Flip over. We're almost done. Let this star, this morning, bright and morning star that Jesus claims he is in the book of Revelation, that comes from Numbers 24, 17 through 19. I see him, but now I behold him. But not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. He will, now think about the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as we read this. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the people of Sheth. Does that sound like the bright and morning star that we encounter in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Edom will be conquered. Seir, his enemy, will be conquered. But Israel will grow strong. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivors of the city. And yet in the book of Revelation, Jesus says, I'm the root and offspring of David, that guy we read about in Isaiah. I'm also the bright and morning star, that one from Numbers. I'm the lion of the tribe of Judah. I'm the predator of the prey. These are challenging images. Why does the author of the book of Revelation choose these violent Hebrew images to associate with the nonviolent Jesus? Notice what Revelation 5 does. Then I what? Go back over there. Just a little. I'm not going to put you through much gymnastics tonight. I just want you to notice one thing. If we look at Revelation 5, 1 through 5, then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scrolls and its seven seals. He only hears about this individual being told to him by one of the elders in 1 through 5. He then turns to look to see who this morning star, this root of Jesse, this lion of Judah is. He turns to see them, and what does he see? Does he see a violent imagery of a predator hunting its prey? It says, then I saw, he turns, the very next passage, then I saw a lamb. We are not talking sheep here. I wish we had a screen that I could put up a picture for you so that you could get the difference. I want you to imagine, if you have a phone, oh, we don't have cell phone signal up here. I can't even Google an image. Imagine with me, not a sheep. Imagine with me right now a lamb. What is a lamb? That is the title tonight. That is a baby sheep. How many can imagine, picture for me in your head, right? How many of you can visualize what a lamb looks like? How many can envision that? You're seeing it in your mind's eye. He hears about this, this lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of Jesse, the bright and morning star who has triumphed. And he turns to see who this is. And what he sees instead of all these violent images is a little baby sheep, a little lamb. And this is just the beginning of how the author of the book of Revelation is going to take these images of the Old Testament. He's going to apply them to Jesus, but in so doing, he's not going to paint a Jesus that looks like those images in character. He's going to take all of these images that we just talked about in Revelation 16, Revelation 14, Revelation 19, Revelation 20. He's going to take all these violent Old Testament images and he's going to turn them upside down. And we're going to walk away from the book of Revelation believing that the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is actually going to bring about the goals of these Old Testament passages and the conversion of the nations. So it's a fascinating book when you come at it from that light. How many are tonight beginning to see that maybe Revelation can be more interesting than what it has been in the past? How many can see that? Yeah, it's taking the violence and saying, no, the conversion of the, not the, the wiping out of our enemies so we can have peace. And I know that's the Adventist interpretation of the book of Revelation. I'm going to be very honest about that. Our interpretation is one day we will have peace on the earth because sin and sinners will be no more. How many have read that language? I get it. I know that's there. I am not going to reconcile that quandary for you this weekend. The challenge is there. What I'm simply going to help you see is how the first early church, who for the first 300 years of following Jesus, all scholars agree that to be a Jesus follower for the first 300 years meant you were a pacifist. Not passive. You chose nonviolent means to convert the world rather than destroying your enemies. You sought to influence the world through enemy love, not enemy destruction. How they would have heard these images and saw these images now that they didn't know how to reconcile in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures. They would begin to see them now being turned on their head through Jesus. So he looks and he sees a lamb looking as if, watch what it says. What have I bolded there? Looking as if, not our enemies. Looking as if, the lion of the tribe of Judah, he comes through and brings peace through slaying them. This is now a lamb looking as if it has been slain. Do you see the difference? Standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. And the Lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out in all the earth. Don't get stuck on the trees. Remember the forest we're looking at tonight. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of him. All of this is in the 17-part series. We don't have time to go into it this weekend, but I encourage you to look for it there. It's absolutely free. I'm not selling you anything. And it says, when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. And each one had a harp. And they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are prayers of the people of God's people. And they sang we're going to talk about that tomorrow. That's one of the best phrases in the book of Revelation, the new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain. And with not our enemies' blood, your blood, you purchased, you ransomed, you liberated. For God, persons from every tribe, language, people, and nation. And you have made them to be a kingdom of priests and to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. We're going to talk about that tribe, language, people, and nation language tomorrow. We talk about Revelation 14 specifically. Revelation 6, 9 through 11. A little bit just to help us understand. It's not just that the Lamb was slain. The book of Revelation calls us to actually follow the Lamb. So notice when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those that had been. That this is not the slaying of our enemies here. This is those who are following the Lamb and being willing to be slain themselves. Now I want to also add a little bit of qualification. This is not the ethic of sacrifice. Those that are being oppressed or that are the victims of injustice, the way of the cross is not telling them to be passive in the face of that injustice and to just sacrifice themselves so that injustice can go on. The way of the cross is not an ethic of sacrifice. It's an ethic of risk. Because you know when you stand up against injustice, when you stand up against oppression, when you stand up against violence, you're going to get pushback, are you not? You get the risk. You take on the risk of saying, the way of the cross is not saying I'm going to let them do to me whatever they want and nothing will change. The way of the cross is, no, I'm going to stand up against injustice, oppression, and violence. And even if they slay me for doing so, I'm going to say this is not right. And I'm going to endeavor to keep trying to win them to a new way of doing life on earth, even if I lose my life in the process. That is a very different ethic than the ethic of sacrifice. Let me give an example. Domestic violence. There are loads of Christian women who have been taught to stay in violent, life-threatening situations because they believe it's Christ-like. Because their understanding, it's not their fault, it's the understanding that's been given to them, is that the way of the cross is the way of sacrifice. So they're just sacrificing themselves rather than trying to make a difference. Does that illustration help you understand a little bit of the difference between the ethic of sacrifice versus the ethic of risk? There is an ethic of risk, but it's the risk of standing up for what is right. Again, there's a difference between being passive. There's a difference between slaying our enemies. It's the ethic of making the world a better place through following the methods put forth by the teachings of the Lamb. I wish we had time to go into Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John this weekend as well, but I want to encourage you. Two series on our website. One is called The Jesus Dialogue. The other is the series I did at AWC just last October called The Revolutionary Jesus. If you'd like to discover more about what those methods are, they're in those two series. Also, we're doing a podcast this year. It started in January, but you can catch up. Those are all free. They come out every week except for this week because I'm in the middle of nowhere and can't upload it. So I don't know what the rest of the world's going to do, but you guys have got it this weekend. Everyone else has to go without. But it's a podcast series called The Sayings of Jesus, where we're just going through the teachings of Jesus. But the point is, in Revelation 6, is not only do we have a Revelation 5 where we have a lamb who's an isolated kind of hero liberator, where it's a unilateral relationship where he's doing all of the liberation. No, he's creating a community of people who are following him and joining him and being willing even to risk their own lives. They're taking up their own cross and they're getting involved. It's not a one person does it for everybody. It's the pioneer of a community where we, in following Jesus, are going out to make a difference in the world that we live. Revelation 14, then I looked, and there before me was a lamb standing on Mount Zion. That's imagery from Psalms 2 that we will look at tomorrow. And with him, 144,000, that is imagery from the book of Numbers that we will look at tomorrow. His name and the name of his father on his foreheads. And I heard the sound from heaven like the roar of rushing waters and like a loud peal of thunder. And the sound I heard was like that of harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song, that's Psalms 96 and 98, which again we'll cover tomorrow. Before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, this is that same throne room imagery, we've never left it. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who'd been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they remained virgins. That's a whole another imagery which we won't go into tomorrow, but it's in the 17-part series. It says they follow, this is the point, the Lamb wherever he goes. They're not just saying he did it for us. They're actually engaging and following and emulating, endeavoring to put into practice what they learned. They're the first fruits of God and the Lamb. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay, that is my introduction to the nonviolence of Jesus. How many can see there's at least a little bit of evidence that the peace scholars have tapped into to say that Revelation might not be as violent as we assume? There might be something else going on. The Revelation is such a precarious book. No other book in the New Testament has been the victim of more varied interpretations than the book of Revelation. Eastern Orthodox don't even believe that the book should have been included in the New Testament. Because they say even if it is nonviolence, the subtlety of nonviolence is so great, so subtle, that most people will miss it. And how many have seen that borne out? Most people's understanding of Revelation, think of Hal Lindsey, think of Left Behind, think of those. The most people's understanding of Revelation is very violent. Let me just give you one more. If you can we do just one more? Would that be okay? I mean, where are you going to go, right?
Yeah. I got a long drive home.
That's so let's look at just one more very briefly. And this is a tangent. It's a side note just to show you another one. We're going to look at more of them tomorrow. But this is one of my favorites that we probably should have left out. You know, like when they make a movie and when it's finally done, you know, you put it on through the editing process and there's tons of material that gets left on the floor because it just diverts from the storyline. What I'm about to show you diverts from the storyline of tonight. But I can't help myself. This is like the deleted scenes at the end of the DVD that you've got to see. This is another, just so you can see the subtleties of what this author is doing in this book. Revelation 11 talks about two witnesses that are slain, then they're resurrected, and everybody follows after them. It says, for 3.5 days when they were slain, for 3.5 days after they were destroyed, some from every tribe, people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies, refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth. What I want you to see in Revelation 11 is that the two prophets were the good guys. These masses of people, every tribe, tongue, language, and these are the bad guys. Can you at least see that in the passage? When the two good guys are slain, how do the bad guys respond? They throw a party. They rejoice. Now, this author is slick because the language he is using here in Revelation 11 is the exact same language of an infamous Jewish holiday. And I'll show it to you. How many are familiar with the book of Esther? Anybody here familiar with Esther? Esther's a couple of you maybe. Okay. You know in the end of the book of Esther, the story of the book of Esther is the Jews were about to be annihilated. But through miraculous events of which Esther was at the center of, the Jews are spared. And then what happens? Watch what it says. That is why rural Jews, those living among the villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as the day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. What are they celebrating? Esther 9, 20 through 22. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the province of King Xerxes. If it was just the sparing of the lives of the Jewish people, how many would think that'd be worth celebrating? But that is not the only thing that's being celebrated in this book, in Esther. It says, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and the 15th days of the month of Adar as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as a month when their sorrow was turned into joy, their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, giving presents of food to one another, gifts to the poor. Why? Go back to verses 2 and 3. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to, what does it say? Attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administration helped the Jews because of the fear of Mordecai had seized them. What is it talking about? Go back one chapter previous, Esther 8, 17. In every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebrating. And many of the people, the other nationalities, became Jews because of the fear of the Jews had seized them. Why were they afraid of the Jews? What happened in the book of Esther? What did they do to their enemies who were seeking their destruction? Did they just say, we forgive you, let bygones be bygones? What did they do in the book of Esther? Does anyone remember? They wiped them out. They slaughtered their enemies. And everybody became afraid of the Jews. And now we celebrate this great victory where not we were slaughtered, our lives were preserved. We celebrate they were slaughtered. That's the holiday we're talking about in the book of Esther. Revelation 11, 11 through 13. But after 3.5 days, the breath of life of God entered them. And they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. Now, who is this? These are they that were just gloating, sending each other gifts, celebrating that these two prophets were. Oh, no, stop right here for just a second. Notice the methods of the Jewish people in Esther, slaying our enemies and then rejoicing over it. That's the bad guys in Revelation 11. Do you see what he's subtly doing? Saying, I know this is our great holiday in the book of Esther, but in Revelation, this is the behavior of them, not us. This is not behavior becoming to us. What will be the result after 3.5 days of this feasting and celebrating that they're dead? The breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. They heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on. And at that very hour, there was a severe earthquake, and a tenth of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in this earthquake. But the survivors did what? Feared God and gave glory to the God of heaven. Again, it's these subtle twists of that which represents this behavior that represents us, and the book of Revelation is going to be attached to them. That's not becoming behavior of us. And I want you to notice what it was that caused them to stand in awe. It wasn't the slaying out of our enemies. It is when we are slain, we are resurrected, we are taken up to heaven, then fear seizes all the onlookers. It's a very different method. Fearing God and giving glory to him, which is the theme, one of the themes of the book of Revelation, it's a very different methodology than just going out and slaying our enemies. Again, Revelation 11 is one of the more subtle moments. This is once again why Eastern Orthodox feel like, man, the book of Revelation shouldn't even be included in the New Testament because people can read that and miss it. How many can agree you could read that and miss it? It's extremely subtle here. Yeah, you can read it and never even notice that, but it's there. Daniel chapter 2, in the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be, what does it say? Nor will it be left to another people. And it will, here's that imagery again, crush all of those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. This again is the Jewish mindset. This is the Jewish paradigm of all of those who would have originally been listening to the book of Revelation. We're going to see the author of the book of Revelation take some of those images tomorrow and subtly twist them. Any questions from anything I said tonight? Thank you once again for listening. Everything we do here at Renewed Heart Ministries, even our many educational events that we do in various venues, is for free. If you'd like to support our work, you can make a one-time gift or become one of our monthly contributors by going to renewedheartministries.com and clicking on the Donate tab on the top right. Or you can mail your contribution to Renewed Heart Ministries, P.O. Box 1211, Lewisburg, West Virginia, 24901. And make sure you also sign up for our free resources and remember, every little bit helps. And as always, anything that we receive over and above our annual budget, we happily give away to other not-for-profits who are making both systemic and personal differences and significant differences in the lives of those who are not presently benefited by the status quo. And to those of you who are already supporting the work of Renewed Heart Ministries, thank you so much. Your generous support makes it possible for us to exist and to continue being a presence for positive change in our world. So with all of our hearts, thank you. Together, we are making a difference till the only world that remains is a world where only love reigns.